And any questions or thoughts about the reading so far, or just the class in general, or I don't know, something else maybe. But if it's about something else, I reserve the right to answer or not. I'll make a game time decision on that. Anything jump out at you, Ted? Anything tonight? Yeah, well, one member of the class has said that they get depressed sometimes, and it encouraged them to know that Spurgeon was depressed some too. And I feel the same way. In fact, we've got a week scheduled to talk about Spurgeon and depression. And the next several weeks, I want to transition just a little bit. We'll get in the weeds a little more, and we'll pick the story back up too later. But I'd really like to start having, I'd like to focus a little more on us all discussing some things and trying to apply things we're learning to today. All right, so we're going to make a little bit of that transition. So we'll discuss just Christian approaches to mental health a little bit and talk about Spurgeon and think through some of those things. I won't make anyone share anything they're not comfortable sharing, of course, but these are things that there are modern and contemporary debates about. Things like depression and Christians and mental health, Christians and trauma, things like that. Tonight we're talking about Spurgeon's impact on society and his kind of commitment to social ministry. So that's a big contemporary debate in modern Christianity, is what's the church's role in social impact, okay, at lots of levels. So we may talk a little bit about, was Spurgeon right or wrong in some of the things he did. Be interested to hear your thoughts. I'll tell you what I think. But we do need to think through some of those things. Let me just say, I will say in lectures to my students, Spurgeon has a lecture that he gives to his students, obviously, called A Minister's Fainting Fits. And I reread it a lot. And I used to reread it more than I do now. Some of you have been here long enough to know why. And I used to read a little more than I do now, but it's still so helpful. And I thought, here's this titan, you know, this guy who you would just assume never had a bad day, and they called him the governor at his church, you know, and everything else, and you thought he probably didn't have any problems at all. But you read his perspective on ministers and depression, and it's super helpful. It's really, really helpful. So we'll talk about that some when we talk about Spurgeon and depression. There's another reason, though. I wanted to be reminded that he had feet of clay. And at this point in his life, or sort of through the core of his ministry at the Tabernacle, we're going to be talking about that a little more now, just the central portion of his life, the bulk of his ministry. This is when he really began to start suffering from pretty pronounced health issues as well, physical health issues, bodily health issues. As you know, a lot of the seeds of his depression were rooted in the event at the Surrey Gardens when folks yelled fire and a bunch of people were trampled. A lot of his depression began then. Of course, I think he was given to it as well. A lot of folks are. A lot of brilliant people are, right? A lot of joyful people are given to depression. I think we assume wrongly that people who seem like they have a melancholy disposition are the only people that are ever depressed. But nothing could be further from the truth. Some people go through bouts of depression. Some people experience long seasons of clinical depression. There's, you know, we are mysterious creatures, right? And we are so glorious and so smart and so much like the Lord. We're created in His image, right? But we're also eerily and weirdly sometimes like animals. It's a good reminder that we're creatures, you know, that we're made just like a dog is. We're not made in the image of God like we are. We're different than the creatures, but we never escape our createdness. That's a good reminder. And the human mind and the human psyche and the human soul is a mysterious thing. One great author. I'm losing it. Hold on. Walker Percy wrote this book called Lost in the Cosmos. And in it, he talks about, he says, isn't it funny that we know all of these things we know about quasars and space and all this kind of stuff, but the thing we understand least is ourselves? And of all the mysteries we understand, the thing we understand least is ourselves. And isn't that true? We are mysteries. And you see the way that depression is such a scary and strange thing. But it is encouraging. If you've gone through depression, clinical depression, or if you're like me and you've gone through fainting fits, it's encouraging to know Spurgeon and these great Titanic Christians went through the same thing. So we'll talk about that some. Anything else jump out at y'all from the reading so far? Anything else?
One thing, I've been a Baptist a long time, but I didn't know we had elders.
Some do, yeah. Some Baptists do have elders. Yeah, pretty much. I think what he's saying, in a sense, right, we do have elders, all right? So nobody panic or anything here. There are all kinds of churches govern themselves differently, right? And I think that the Scripture is leaves leeway for how a church can be governed, okay? I think the Bible describes the way churches are governed a lot, but I don't think there's just one book you open up and it's called Polity and you read it and you see it. I think the New Testament leaves it intentionally pretty open, but by and large, every church, to be a biblical church, needs some level of leadership, obviously, and that's deacons and elders or pastors. So I would argue in the New Testament that there are three words that all mean pastor. Okay? So pastor means pastor. Elder means pastor, and overseer means pastor. So when, for example, Paul tells Timothy to respect his elders, he's talking about the pastors in his church or the pastors that he has. So I don't think he's talking about people that are older than him. He's talking about elders. So those are just three words, and I'm trying to think of the Greek. One's presbyteros, one is episkopos, and I think episkopos is overseer. I think presbyteros is elder, and I don't know what the word for pastor is. Ben, do you know the Greek word for shepherd, for pastor? It's shepherd. I'll remember it at some point. Anyway, so do you hear those? All right, so did y'all hear those words? Episkopos means overseer, presbyteros means elder. Do those sound similar to anything you've heard before? Episkopos kind of sounds like Episcopalian, right? So, and presbyteros kind of sounds like Presbyterian, right? So, basically, these are ways over time churches have taken these terms in the New Testament. And I think some traditions tend to separate out what an elder is, what a bishop is, what a pastor is, right? Three different. In the New Testament, they're used interchangeably, I think. All one title, one way. So,
if you're an elder, you could also be a deacon or vice versa, right?
I think sometimes they would become one or vice versa. In the same way that, like, for example, Larry Furman's been a pastor, and he's been a pastor here at this church, right? He's been our minister of education here, among other roles in different churches, and he's now a deacon, right? So by and large, then what they do in different churches, they just rule the church in different ways. Whereas some churches have a group of pastors that they call elders. Presbyterians have a group of elders or pastors that they call the session, right? And then other churches have like a board that they might call a vestry or a board or something like that. In our church, we have deacons, a body of deacons, and we have a group of ministers or people who are pastors who have shepherding duties over the church. So again, Spurgeon really had a real high view of Spurgeon's church had a real high view of Spurgeon's leadership, if you haven't noticed. But then the deacons also helped lead the church there as well and functioned in a high leadership role as well. But the elders, it seems like in Spurgeon's church, were by and large there to help care and shepherd for the congregation. So you got to understand, I think one thing we have to understand about elders and pastors and deacons and boards and all these kind of things, we're all using similar terminology, but oftentimes we all mean different things by them, right? And So I always
consider Brent an elder.
Well, I don't. Yeah. Well, if he were a pastor here, he would be an elder, right? And but he's a deacon, so he's a He's a diakonos, which means servant in the New Testament, right? So, but like Woody and Nathan and myself would all be people who have the title pastor here. So in the New Testament language, we'd all be considered elders. So sometimes people come and ask me in lots of different directions, does your church have elders? You know, and some people are like, really want us to have elders, and some people really don't want us to have elders. And my answer always is, yeah, we do. We have three pastors in our church, you know, and we are New Testament elders or overseers as well. The question is, why is that such a hot button issue? I think there's a few things, Brant. I think really what people want, I don't think it always is. It's almost always a hot button issue, typically only at a local level. I've very rarely seen it as a hot button issue outside just an individual local church. It's not like Calvinism where you've got broader big debates happening about this. People are talking about how to run a church, which is a good thing. You know, like how should a church be run biblically? But normally it's at a local level. And for me, this is my perspective. Okay, I think when people panic, what people really care about is where the word rule falls on the spectrum. Every church has a pastor or pastors. Every biblical church. Basically, every church has deacons, right? Functionally has deacons, people who serve and give accountability and those kinds of things. Pretty much every church at one level or another has committees, right? And if it's a church, it's a congregation, right? So if you think about it, every church has some semblance of those four things. If you go back and look, any church, you can all go in your mind right now and think of times in the church or times in your life where you've looked and you've seen. Has anybody ever seen a committee in a church get out of control? No, never. Right? Have y'all ever seen a committee try to rule a church? Yeah, of course you have. Have you ever seen a congregation try to rule a church all the time and make every decision through business meetings? Just out of control business meetings. You know, yeah, of course you have. Have you ever seen a group of deacons try to rule and run a church in an unhealthy way? Get out of control. Yeah. What about a pastor? Y'all ever seen a pastor run buck wild in the church and get out of control? Of course you have, right? So the question becomes where that word rule falls. Who's the final authority in the life of the church? Well, I think the Bible teaches, by and large, and this is what I think our Constitution plays out. This is how I interpret our Constitution. That we're, you can go read it and test me if you want to. That's fine. I think we're pastorally led. And that's leadership in a New Testament sense, not in a corporate America sense. So our pastors are called to give leadership to the church. So we don't call anyone here a pastor who's not giving broad shepherding leadership to the congregation as a whole. Okay? So that's why, for example, we wouldn't call Cole our youth pastor. Love Cole. I think he'll probably be a pastor one day. You know, it might even be a senior pastor one day. But right now, he's given narrow leadership to our student ministry. Right? So he's not shepherding the church as a whole. So he's just not a pastor here. So myself, Woody, Nathan, we're all given broader leadership in the church. And the church has set us apart through ordination. Well, you know, we're pastors. So the pastor, and in particular in our church, the lead or senior pastor, is given a broad sense of leadership. And I partner with our staff and in our pastors to help lead the church. One of the big prerogatives the Constitution here gives the pastor here is to set forth a program for the church to kind of go by. We call it a vision or something like that, you know. And the Constitution says, and the church will ever retain unimpaired its ability to basically vote that down. You know, so y'all get sick of whatever I say, you can just vote it down. We're not going to do it, you know. And then I'll just say, well, I'll just find some people that want to do what God's put on my heart to lead. You know, that's okay, whatever, you know. Whatever. If y'all want it, you can have it, you know? And there's other churches. I want to be here till I die, hopefully by God's grace. It's my prayer, but I don't know. I don't know what God has. Y'all might get sick of me. I'm not going to presume upon that. All right. So pastors lead, they don't rule. Deacons serve, and they give good accountability for our pastors. They help lead the church in lots of different ways, but they're mainly there to help serve the congregation and to take things off the pastor's hands so the pastors can focus on mainly prayer and preaching and teaching the word, right? And leadership in that way. All right. Third of all, we have committees that we organize by. We just have committees that organize our church. Now, we also have committees that have authority. right? They lead. Our finance committee has leadership authority, and others, personnel, others. But at the same time, it's mainly how we organize. The church votes these people in to make sure that we're running in an organized way. And finally, we are congregationally ruled. Under Christ, the final authority in the church is the congregation. But all these offices are means by which the congregation rules itself, right? So for me, Brent, the reason it becomes a big issue is people are wondering where that word rule is going to fall. And I've just seen over the years, typically, churches can get in a little bit of a jam when that word rule falls in the wrong place. Who's got the final authority in the church? I don't see a sense in the New Testament where that final authority ought ever to belong to a board of any sort. Anytime bodies in churches become boards, I think you can start, you know, the people with the final authority, you can start to have a little bit of a problem.
Do you think it's probably a hot button issue because some people have a personal experience that have been burned by something?
Yeah, or I mean, there are sometimes, okay, there's lots of, I can't adjudicate every experience anyone's had or every situation. It becomes a hot button issue when it comes up because what people are really asking is, are you trying to take control of our church and are you trying to radically adjust our way of life? And those are really two questions every person asks all the time about everything.
But sometimes it's because people who should be doing some leadership have failed in leading.
Yeah, I think that's fair too, right? And again, there's all kinds of ways to lead a church, and I don't think every church that, for example, has elder rule is unbiblical. I think it's really clear, or you know what I mean, where there's a group of pastors who have authority in the church. I don't necessarily think that's a totally unbiblical way of doing things. I just don't think it's the only way the Bible prescribes for things to be done. I'm personally a congregationalist, right? So I'm not a Presbyterian, and I'm not a Reformed Baptist in the sense that I think that elders ought to have the final say and authority in a church. I think pastors ought to have leadership. So what will happen a lot of times, Brent, is a pastor will come into a church. He's got a set of convictions about how a church ought to be run. Good things he thinks he sees is in the Bible, right? That's good. I hope you want me to see things in the Bible and want to line this church up with it. That's a good thing, right? But a lot of times guys get a kind of myopia about this in particular and think that the way to solve every problem in a church is by having a healthy group of elders, right? To run the church in that way. They see that as the only biblical way. Of course, I always like to joke with that with my Presbyterian friends and say, as you guys know, a church automatically becomes healthy when it has elders, right? You know, and they always die laughing because there's some messed up sessions out there, right, guys? And there's some messed up Baptist elder boards too, you know? There's some messed up deacon boards. There's some messed up committees. There's some messed up churches. But people come in, they say the only healthy way for us to fix these things is by doing this. And then it becomes a disaster, you know? And this happens as much, if not more often, when one pastor or one deacon or one committee tries to take power for themselves and they never say the word elder at all. And we've all seen that happen, right? But just churches are hard. Well, the other thing I say is Baptists by design are not easy to lead. You know, we're designed by design, Baptists are bottom up, right? It's the design of the thing. So it's just hard to lead Baptists, period, by design. And that's good. I need to be frustrated in trying to get God's people to do things.
That's an example of a Southern Baptist Convention that just happened.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And listen, we're not getting into that. But I'll just tell you, if you want to come sit on the porch, we'll get into that. But not here. So Spurgeon's church would have had elders. That would have been people who were helping Spurgeon and their ministry staff in the process of leading and shepherding the church.
Annual butcher's meal.
I'm trying to think of an example. Well, you know, for example, we host Gadsden Middle School graduation here, right? And sometimes other groups will have events here because they need a facility for it. So there weren't as many public facilities in London in this day as there were, you know, then as there are even now. So that was just a group of butchers that just used the tabernacle. Yeah, they just used a facility like Gazan Middle School would for
a church member.
there probably were church members involved a lot like here. For example, we have a city councilman in our church, and sometimes he'll have meetings with constituencies in our family life center. You know, it's not really a church event, but he happens to be a member, so of course we're going to let him, you know, use it or whatever. Or, you know, school teams practice or just what different things happen here. Yeah, that's what that was. Yeah. This is a good question, though, but I'd like to go. He was talking about all the sides of beef they brought in there and cooked, you know. Yeah, those are good questions. Does that make sense, guys, what I'm talking about in terms of ecclesiology? I'm not trying to run down my Presbyterian friends or others who believe in elders. I mean, there are clearly elders in the Bible. They're pastors. And there's usually, at most churches in the New Testament, it seems like that word is used in a plural way, right? So I think what the New Testament's trying to get at when it's talking about a plurality of pastors in a church, I think it's trying to prevent is one guy becoming this kind of egomaniac and having all the authority to himself, right? So if you think about it, if you thought that the pastor ought to run the church, rule the church, right? Now, one thing I know about Baptists, they have a real high view of pastoral leadership, right? They don't want to be abused or be mistreated, but they want the pastor to lead. You know, they have a high respect for the pastor. But imagine we took it a step further and you just thought the pastor ought to be the final authority in the church. All right? Wouldn't it be better if there was more than one? If the pastor had final authority in the church, right? Well, in the same way here, I've got a pretty good bit of authority in the church. I'm a leader here. I mean, every pastor, the least authoritative pastor in the world, still got a lot of authority. If you're standing up preaching God's word every Sunday, you've got a lot of influence over people, right? It's good for those men to not be on an island. It's good to have a group around you. And we're intentionally trying to build that here. But that doesn't mean that we have a group of pastors and a staff and other levels of accountability, including our deacons, that are around the pastor, the lead pastor. I don't think that's an unbiblical idea, have a senior pastor, a lead pastor. But I say all that just to simply say, though, if what I was trying to do is take authority from the congregation or take responsibility from other groups that really ultimately belongs to them and then situate it in a board of, quote, elders, that's usually when there's a problem, right? Not that we call more than one person a pastor in our church. We rejoice in that. You know, we love that.
Everyone should have, in my opinion, checks and balances.
That's how it's done here. There's a lot of wisdom. I think it's a really good way to do it. I love our Constitution. I'm happy as a lark can get the lead in this kind of context, you know. I don't have people, you know, there are some folks that like to vote no just because they think somebody ought to vote no. We don't really have that kind of culture here, you know. We're here to get the gospel of the nations, you know what I mean? But at the same time, I don't just have a golden ticket to do whatever, and neither do our pastors, neither do our deacons, neither does any committee. Ultimately, we have a really good system that's built out here. I think it reflects the scriptures really well. There are other good systems that do also. You just have to be really careful, you know, in how we make adjustments. Oh, last thing I'll say, Brant. I mean, you know what the biggest four-letter word in any church is, right? Change. You know, sometimes folks are trying to make good changes and get blistered for it too. So that's sometimes why anything can become a hot topic in a church if it involves the C word, you know. And I don't think anybody needs to change for change's sake, but we also know churches and organizations, institutions that become so determined not to change anything that they'd rather die than change. Well, that's a problem too, you know. And usually, when something becomes a hot topic in a church, a big issue, usually it's a cocktail of a lot of different issues that come together. All right. Any other thoughts or things to reflect on? Any questions about any of that? All right. Well, now I'm now officially going to be recorded and on the internet, on the record, on that. Tonight, I want to talk a little bit about Spurgeon's impact on society, and really, ultimately, the tabernacle's impact on society. And I want us to think a little bit tonight about, okay, let me ask y'all this. Have you guys heard these two words put together in the last 5 or 6 years? Have you guys heard these two words? Social justice. Has anybody heard this? All right. Speaking of hot topics, right? Social justice. Have you guys heard this? Raise your hand if you haven't. What if you haven't? Haven't heard social justice. All right. Well, this is a debate that our society's having, right? What is social justice? How should it come to bear in our lives? They center around all kinds of different things. These two words together have really come to have a negative or hyper positive, depending on where you live or what you think, connotation to them really in just the last few years. Historically, when we've talked about these kinds of things, like 10 years ago, I would have said something like, abortion is a social justice issue. And people would have thought, okay, that sounds, makes sense, you know, or Christians should be involved in social justice issues. I would say something like that. I wouldn't now because everybody in the room rolls their eyes when they hear the words because of the way they've been hijacked in lots of ways, right? This kind of social justice thing. But over time, what social justice really ultimately just means is just justice as it plays out in society among people, right? So I did not say social justice about Spurgeon. I might have 10 years ago. And then I would have been just trying to be a little provocative. I'm saying societal impact tonight. But so I'm bringing all this up for a reason, not because I'm a woke guy now or anything like that or ever have been or whatever. I hate that word, but whatever. You know what woke means, don't you? Somebody disagrees with you and you can call them woke and that's an argument. Anyway, but I'm saying societal impact because the reality is the way Christians deal with society and the way we impact society really is on a spectrum, right? There's lots of different ways to think about what role we ought to have in society. There are some people who have a very narrow understanding of how Christians ought to impact society. They say things like, we just need to just preach the gospel, right? So just preach the gospel. Now, not everyone who says that really means that. because they talk about all kinds of things besides the gospel, right? And anytime somebody says, just preach the gospel, my first question is, well, what about abortion? What should we do there? Should we just let it ride and just preach the gospel and just wait till that ends? What about murder in general? You know, should we speak out against that? You know, how do you feel about that? What about, like, our dental clinic? Are we wrong to pull teeth? Or should we just preach? I mean, it's a real answer, right? I mean, I've never led anybody to Jesus at the dental clinic. So those are the kind of questions I ask people on that side. Well, then, though, you've got the opposite end of the spectrum. And there are some folks who have... So you've got one thing that's all gospel, right? It's just all... We have a spiritual message, and we're winning souls, and that's that, right? Well, then there's another side of the spectrum, right, that you might even call a social gospel. And when you hear social justice, I think this is the error you think of primarily, which is someone who thinks that justice in this life is all the justice that matters. And there have been movements like this for centuries, really, that really focus. One social gospel movement is called liberation theology. This was born out of Roman Catholicism in South America, in a place where people were authentically oppressed. You know, that's another word that we kind of... You know, start ticking when you hear the word oppression these days, you know, Christians do, because it feels like everybody's oppressed these days. There's some people that are really oppressed, guys. Let's not forget that, you know. And it's a word the Bible uses about people, and God hates it. So let's not forget that. But there were Roman Catholic priests in South America who went to oppress people and basically said, the gospel is to tell you that Jesus died to overthrow oppression and that you need to overthrow your oppressors and be liberated, and that's the gospel. Well, neither of those, I don't think any of us here feel like either of those is appropriate. Now, I'll just go ahead and tell you, if I have to choose one, all right, if I got to choose one, I'm choosing just preach the gospel, okay? Because at least we're preaching the gospel. It might be a truncated gospel. It might be a limited gospel. It might be one that doesn't take all the implications that the gospel has and apply them in the world today, but at least it's preaching the gospel. But then you've got this other side over here, a liberation theology. It's so focused on earth that it doesn't save anybody, right? It's not a gospel at all. So I'm out on this. So, all right, as we think through Spurgeon and his life, I want to hear what you guys think about this sort of contemporary debate. Let's think about where Spurgeon falls on this, okay, guys? And see what we think when we walk through some of these things. All right, here's just different things Spurgeon did to impact society. Here's the first one. He started a monthly magazine called The Sword and the Trowel, all right? And this was meant to deal with issues, to go out to his churches. It was meant to help strengthen them. He wrote an article for it every month. The tagline of The Sword and the Trowel was, "In combat with sin and labor for the Lord," which I love, you know. It's real. Most of us are probably either all sword or all trowel by nature, you know. I'm by nature a sword guy, you know, not a very good one. I'm like Peter, you know. If I pulled the sword out, I'd, you know, cut off somebody's head, I'd get an ear instead, you know, that kind of thing. But some of us may, or I don't know, are any of you guys like adversarial or contrarian by nature? Anybody here like me? I'm a little bit like that. What do you think, Whit? A little bit, yeah. Anybody else? Anybody else adversarial? Does anybody else like, who likes conflict? Anybody like conflict? Who's going to admit it? I know for a fact somebody in here does. No, I'm just kidding. You know, you know, most of us are either fight or flight. You know what I mean? Like, most of us are one or the other. One time I did tell our deacons in deacons meeting, at the end of deacons meeting, I said, "Guys, I love you so much. Thank you for not trying to fight with me all the time. I like it too much, you know? And it would do bad things to my soul to fight all the time. I've worked hard by God's grace and by Spirit to become a more ironic, peaceful man. That's who I want to be at heart." So, you know, I tend, though, to want to be in combat with sin. It's sort of like in a meeting the other day, we were talking, when I was talking about Paul and Peter's conflict. You all remember this text in Galatians where Paul opposes Peter to his face when he came to Antioch? And Nathan was talking about how much it grieved him as he's preparing the worship service. He's like, "Man, it's like there's conflict everywhere, and then it's here in the Bible too." And I was like, man, that's awesome that Paul was willing to confront him to his face, you know, like he, to his face in front of everybody, you know. I think it's so bold. That's great. So anyway, the sword and the trowel in combat with sin and labor for the Lord. But it's important, though, that we do both, right? We don't go looking for fights, but we do need to combat sin. There is a war with powers and principalities. We have to be bold in the Lord. We have to be willing to stand when it's time to stand. If the day ever came, by God's grace, I hope and pray that I had pressure put on me to step away from the Word of God or to preach another gospel or to equivocate on something God said clearly. You know, my prayer is that that would be a sword day for me. But we also have to be builders, right? To be in service for the Lord, to use the trowel. So I love the title of that. That began in 1865. It's a monthly magazine. I think that was a big source of research for Tom Nettles in this book and his bigger book. He was one of the first people who really went to those original sources for a Spurgeon biography. So you've gotten a glimpse of some of the things Spurgeon wrote by reading this book. He did other publishing as well. By the end of his life, he had over 140 separate titles published, not counting his sermons that were published, over 3,000 sermons. That was a weekly publishing work. So every week, we are going to talk in a few weeks about his marriage. He met his wife at New Park Street. So she was a member there at the church, or a tender at the church when he got there. And they began their courtship then. And Monday mornings was one of the time he would go spend with her, but he always had to bring the sermon with him to edit because it had to be ready to be published on Monday morning. So if any of you ever feel ignored by your spouse, you could have been Susie Spurgeon, who I'll tell you some stories about that later. So anyway, just in 1865, he published Morning by Morning. Later, he published Evening by Evening. That's now published together, morning and evening devotionals called Morning and Evening. The Tabernacle had their own hymn book called Our Own Hymn Book that Spurgeon published. This is just in 1865 when he started Sword and the Trowel. And then also he began the writing of his commentary on the Psalms called The Treasury of David. It turned into a big seven-volume work, significant work. So that's other publishing Spurgeon did. It's another way he impacted society. Now we'll get into a little more social ministry. All right? I'm going to keep saying social because I want to watch Ted kind of shiver when I say social, you know. Almshouses. So this is John Rippon, who was a previous pastor, started almshouses. After the tabernacle was built, they moved and improved the almshouses. There were 17 of them, and widows lived in these houses. And so the church helped supply money for these, but it was a, you can imagine paying for 17 houses. It's a lot of money. And Spurgeon often used his personal money to pay for heat and other things there in that house. Spurgeon also started a coal porter ministry. Coal porter is basically peddler in French. And Spurgeon had heard of ministries where people sold Bibles and tracts as an evangelistic tool, sold them at cost, go out in all these different areas. So, you know, now we podcast our sermons for free, right? Well, in Spurgeon's day, they sold Bibles and tracts and copies of his sermons and things like that, sold them at cost, and they supported these coal porters. They put up half their salary a year, and they had to earn the rest through their sales, but they sold them very cheaply for folks, and that was one way they helped spread the gospel all through England. So there are over 100 coal porters at the highest point of Spurgeon's ministry. I'll just read a little bit about this. This is from Arnold Dallimore. Let me mention one controversy really quick because I like this. This is so British. Spurgeon wrote a preached a sermon. So, and you start thinking about 19th century Anglicanism. There was a movement called Tractarianism among Anglicans, and it was kind of a movement back toward the Roman Catholic Church and the Anglican Church. And Spurgeon really thought the evangelical guys really fought against that movement back to so there were evangelical Anglicans during the time. They really fought against Tractarianism during this time. Some of these tendencies are still alive in the Anglican fellowship worldwide. But anyway, they fought against it. But Spurgeon felt like he encouraged them in that so much that finally he realized that he couldn't any longer not say something about what he called baptismal regeneration. So the idea, which I don't know many of my friends who practice infant baptism who believe that it's regenerative, right? So they don't believe their kids are saved because they've been baptized. Most that I know don't, but some did at this point. And so Spurgeon went to his publishers and said, I'm about to preach a sermon against baptismal regeneration and against infant baptism, essentially. And I just want you to know I'm going to lose a lot of sermons. I mean, I'm going to lose a lot of money. You're going to lose a lot of money because people are going to stop buying my sermons. Well, like, that sermon was published, and it was so controversial that it sold like triple the copies, you know, and people are hate buying it, you know, too. And so there's this guy named, here, Dallimore talks about this. Spurgeon's action cost him many friends. Lord Shaftesbury, who had stood with him in his charitable endeavors, now said, it's a really withering critique, you are a very saucy fellow. I thought, whew, man, Lord Shaftesbury, you tone it down, you know. Anyway, all right. You are a very saucy fellow. So British. It was a more refined age, guys. Let me just read to you a little bit about the coal porters. Let me see. The coal porter did much more than sell Bibles and books. Here's one of Spurgeon's biographers described it like this. The coal porter converses with the inmates about their souls, prays with the sick, and leaves a tract at each cottage. He is frequently able to hold prayer meetings, open-air services, and Bible readings. He gets a room, if possible, and preaches, founds bands of hope, and makes himself generally useful in the cause of religion and temperance. He is, in fact, first of all, a missionary, then a preacher, and by, in the truest sense, a pastor. We have some noble men in this work. So this is a means by which, through selling Bibles, Bible salesmen, and tract salesmen, and book salesmen, it's a means by which they were evangelizing England through the coal porter ministry. I think any just preach the gospel guy can get on board with that. All right, the almshouses? I don't know. Should we be putting that much money into housing widows? We have to ask that. All right. There was also a pastor's college. In 1865, there were 93 students actively in the pastor's college, plus another 200 in evening classes. But then also, Spurgeon was passionate about starting orphanages. So pages 126 and 127 of Dalimore. Let me just read a little to you here about the orphanages. I love this. At the very time, this is a good story, I'm going to read it to you. The very time in which he was building the almshouses, Spurgeon was building also another and much larger institution, an orphanage. The orphanage came about in the following manner. In addressing his prayer meeting in the summer of 1866, Spurgeon said, "Dear friends, we are a huge church and should be doing more for the Lord in this great city. I want us tonight to ask him to send us some new work. And if we need money to carry it on, let us pray that the means may also be sent." A few days later, Spurgeon received a letter from a Mrs. Hilliard stating she had some £20,000 which she would like to devote to the training and education of orphan boys. It's a lot of money in the 1800s. Pretty good amount now, you know. It was a lot then. From a human point of view, this is an unlikely offer. Mrs. Hilliard was the widow of a Church of England clergyman. So Spurgeon and a deacon go. They get there, and they get to the house, and it doesn't just appear like the place where you're getting this huge bequest, you know? So they go in, and Spurgeon says, "We have called, madam, about the £200 that you mentioned in your letter." And she says, "200," she replied. "I meant to write 20,000. He said, "Oh, yes, you did put 20,000, said Spurgeon, "but I was not sure whether a knot or two may have slipped in by mistake, and I thought I would be on the safe side," you know? So he's being really, really careful. He tries to convince her to give the money to something else, but in the end, she wants to give it to Spurgeon. So it's kind of a neat thing. Here's a good little, this is one of my favorite Spurgeonisms, all right? This is also from Dalmore. One day an agnostic accosted Spurgeon, came up to him, and challenged his Christian beliefs. And Spurgeon pointed out the failure of the unbelievers' organizations to take on any definite and sustained program of help to the thousands of needy around them. In contrast, he pointed to the works that sprang from evangelical Christianity, and he closed the conversation by paraphrasing the triumphant cry of Elijah, vigorously asserting as well he might, "The God who answereth by orphanages, let him be God." I love that quote. You know, okay. So there's church planting. He influenced scores and scores and scores of pastors. He helped other churches in England through his ministry grow. And I think the question before us is, what role does the church have in societal impact? Now, obviously, every Christian everywhere would agree on preaching the gospel. And I'm on record a bunch as saying that's primarily what we do. In fact, it's kind of funny. Several years ago, I got interviewed by the Gazan Times for like 35. You guys remember they did this like 35 under 45 in Etowah County or whatever. And I was one of the 35 under 45. And I hope that doesn't come across as bragging. I'm just telling the story. All right. That's about the top of my fame in life. Just so y'all know. I've maxed out that and getting interviewed on WBSA twice in Boaz in the last couple years during call and tell. So they're asking me about the church, and then people call in and say, "Yeah, we got some bushels of corn down here for sale. If you want to come, it's this address." And they say, "All right, if you want to go to so-and-so, you go buy some corn." What were you saying about your church, Matt? So that's kind of that's my fame. That's about what I deserve. Really, even less than that. If you've never listened to Call and Tell, it's fantastic, by the way. So anyway, I'm getting interviewed, and I mean, I think the person interviewing is a believer, but these things, if you're familiar with these things, whatever, and different, they're oftentimes wanting to talk about philanthropy and community impact and that kind of stuff. And so those were the kind of questions they kept asking me. How do you feel like your church impacts Gadsden? You know, like, what's your philanthropy? What do you do? Like, how do you serve the city? And I said, well, the main thing that we offer is the preaching of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Like, the biggest blessing we have for Gadsden is to stand up every week and preach the gospel. And I've noticed over the years, and this guy's a friend. I mean, he wasn't being ugly or anything. I've noticed over the years that I get that question a lot. So what are y'all actually doing for folks? Like that, you know, what are y'all actually do? What are you really actually doing? And I'm like, listen, the best thing we can offer this city is the gospel. But I do think we've got to ask ourselves, how do we adorn the gospel, and what are the implications of the gospel and how we impact the world around us? So here's why I think it's important, because I think the contemporary debate and the way that this side of things makes us recoil, and even the very idea of something like social justice or a social gospel or social impact, I think this makes us feel so icky and frustrated, right? We're trying so hard to prove that we are not social gospel people, right? That I think we may be leaving some things in the lurch. I think we may be, as not just here, but I mean as the church as a whole, I'm fearful of the way that I'm afraid Christians are going to withdraw from society in the coming years. So what do you guys think? What do you think about orphanages and almshouses and impacting society in those ways, helping the poor? Are those things the church ought to be doing, or should we just preach the gospel? Where's the line? Where's the balance? What do you guys think? I think so.
So you concur?
Yeah.
You should do, yes.
Well, James says, right? Caring for orphans and widows in their distress. Right. You know, this is true religion, the sign of our God. Okay.
I think if we did what we really needed to do, that we wouldn't have a lot of that problem anymore, because we would be taking care of people instead of letting them go hungry and homeless.
I think we could make a big difference. I think we do. This is, to me, I will just go ahead and say, to me, this is like the biggest frustration I have all the time, is people are always, everyone's always talking about what Christians ought to be doing, and Christians are doing it. You know?
Doesn't our church promote all of it just because, you know, every year we have the Christmas offering for the children's
home? Yes, I do think we do. Yeah, I'm not just talking about our church, just bear in mind. I mean the church, capital C church as a whole. Yeah.
I think the church used to do it a whole lot more. I still think we do, but I think the government can play some of that. I mean, churches started colleges, churches started hospitals, churches started, you know, orphanages, and maybe sometimes it's screwed up. And before there was like a welfare system, that was the church.
Right.
You know, and like the sacrifice you see in the early church, like, I want to help, but I'm not like, hey, Christian brother, borrow my car. You know what I mean? Like
right.
The stuff that you see. So I think we do our stuff, but I do think some churches, and I've been a part of them, kind of check our box. What do you do?
Yeah.
Oh, well, we pack some bags on Sunday. You
right.
You know what I mean? It's some of our church doing is not us individually, like our lives, and how we live it out all the time. Like,
yeah.
I take credit for stuff I don't do because I'm part of this church.
Yeah.
You know?
I agree. One thing I will say, though, I agree. But a lot of those things that we're talking about that the government's done, the government wouldn't be doing if it wasn't for Christians talking them into doing it.
Sure.
So the great social reforms of the last 200-300 years really oftentimes are oriented in among Christian people. You know, we can give example after example of that. You know, like Wilberforce and the slave trade, Christians who are involved. You know, one thing we talked about when I was in my last D-Men seminar, we were talking about Spurgeon, people talking about him working himself to death. You know, basically, he just worked himself to death. And I say one thing I mentioned is, you know, one thing we've missed in thinking about Spurgeon and thinking about the London in which Spurgeon pastored are the great labor reform movements that happened on the other side of the Industrial Revolution, right? Like, who likes the weekend? You know, I like a weekend. It didn't exist. You know what I mean? So that's a new thing. And for a long time, you know, those kinds of things didn't exist. So I agree, though. Yeah, I think it's important, right, for us to be involved in social things at some level. So I will say, all right, I've given easy questions now so far. Nobody's sitting there thinking Christians ought not to care for orphans and widows. You know, that's directly in the Bible. But what do we care about? And I think this is something I want you all to carry home with you. Okay, and think about. I don't have all the direct answers because it's a challenging world we live in, right? You've got partisanship. You do have false gospels. You do have churches and traditions that have abandoned the preaching of the truth, right? And all they do is build orphanages and hospitals. And now they don't have enough money to even do that, you know? So they theoretically think that's important. It's like I've had folks tell me before, you know, Southern Baptists used to build hospitals. And I always say, well, why doesn't your church build a hospital? Well, they don't have money, you know? Okay, Southern Baptist, there's a finite amount of Baptist dollars, right? What should we be putting that money toward? I don't know exactly. Should it all be to missionaries? Should some of it be to some of these other social? Now, we're doing a lot, right? We have things like send relief. We pack boxes. I mean, we do different things. We have the mission center here, those sorts of things. But you do recognize, though, right, what I'm saying? Every dollar we spend on that's a dollar we don't spend on getting the gospel to the nations. So, I mean, I don't have clear answers on all this, but I do want to make sure that what we're all doing is thinking clearly on these things. And I want to ensure that anytime anybody says something like social impact or impact on society or even social justice, not all social justice is wonky woke stuff, right? Again, I really believe that abortion is a societal justice issue. If God wasn't just, I don't think we would care as much about abortion, right? We'd care about any murders. If human beings weren't created in the image of, I mean, you know, nobody gets mad when a coyote kills and eats. Unless it's your dog, but you know what I mean. You know, that's what they do. It's what animals do, right? Or whatever. Nobody's having a murder trial for a dog. Because they're not creating the image of God, but we are for us. Do what?
That's come.
Yeah, I'm afraid. Right? We're missing some. Yeah, no, you're right, Marguerite. No, you're exactly right. And this is some of what we have to do, though, is I think this is to Paul's point. This isn't just happening in institutionally. This is happening in the world of ideas as well, right? So, for example, let me ask you this question. Should Christians care about the environment? Honest question. What do y'all think? Yeah. But if I got up on a Sunday and the title of my sermon was Christians in the Environment, people would start twitching a little bit, getting a little nervous, you know. What's going on with the preacher? What's happened, you know? What's he going to preach on this week? But here's what I'm saying is we're trying so hard not to be this, right? That we're allowing folks to step into this space and now, next thing you know, we are having murder trials for dogs because we don't have any kind of a Christian or godly view of things like the environment or what it means to be made in the image of God or these sorts of things. All I mean to say in all of this is Christians ought to lead the way in the godly transformation of society. I don't think we do it through political clout and power necessarily. We certainly don't do it in ungodly ways. It's not our primary mission, but it's part of a vision that we need to have for the world. And I think we need to be really careful in picking and choosing that which we feel like is okay to talk about from the scriptures and that which isn't. And so I want you, as you think through these things, as you think through race, I'll tell you what race has been such a big issue in the last few years. I've seen the way that things that pastors and preachers could have said 6 years ago are called unbiblical today. You know, like ideas like, you know, our churches ought to reflect the racial, ought to try to reflect the racial makeup of their communities. You ought to try to reach everybody in your city. There are people, I've seen people call that very notion woke, you know, today, which I find to be ridiculous. You know, like, I want to reach everybody with the gospel, right? I think we need to think through all sorts of different issues that come up and the temptation to either withdraw from it or just walk in lockstep with the world on it, say whatever they say back to them. Both of those are really bad temptations right now. And I say all that to say, Spurgeon, I think, gave us a really good example of how to walk that balance. I've yet to find an issue that I didn't feel like Spurgeon did a pretty good job on, you know, in terms of how he dealt with it in society, with grace and love, but also with clarity and that sort of thing. So I wanted us to kind of think through that tonight as we think about the impact. But I also wanted you to get a sense of all that was going on. This is what Dallimore calls the Spurgeonic enterprises. And there's just a lot going on. All right, any questions or thoughts? If you need to go to choir, I think I'm out of time, but I'll stay and entertain questions right now. Or thoughts, feedback.
Sometimes I feel like we turn it into just another legalistic checkbox. And even service things for athletic teams, and like, you know, the stars show up, get their picture, and then they're gone.
Right.
And they do a big write up on all this community service they did. It's like, you know, do anything. Like, you know, or like filling out resumes. You know, it's like you do things to prop yourself up, or, you know, as long, it doesn't really matter what you do, as long as it's like I told somebody about, like, when there was all the debate about COVID. It matters what you do, but it's more important what it looks like you're doing.
It's about right.
But I'm saying, like, I feel like that's a trap, too. It's like, just, you know, let's do our service for Instagram.
Yeah.
The world. Talk about what we're doing.
Yeah, we've talked about that for a long time. Go into Africa so you can take a picture with a little kid, you know, for your Facebook profile. Yeah.
What did the church, the Baptist, think about slavery before 1865?
But depending on what part of the world, what part of the church you were in. Spurgeon was an adamant abolitionist. In fact, his sermons were burned in Montgomery. Because he was an abolitionist. You know, our Southern Baptist theological forebears were very much in favor of slavery. So the church was really split on that. But people like William Wilberforce and others in England helped end the sort of international slave trade in a lot of ways. So the church has been a mixed bag on that. A lot of it depended on where you were born and how much your living depended on slave labor. You know, and so that's a good thought. But the question, you know, again, we're all real good with orphans and widows, right? Start talking about some of this other stuff, we start to think, okay, what exactly is our role in that? You know, we're real good on abortion, and we should be. You know what I mean? And we're real clear on what we ought not to be doing and what we ought to be doing. It's that in the middle that we're all kind of trying to wrestle with. And what I want you to just do, I'm not saying I've got all the answers. I don't know what the answer is on how the church needs to be handling race issues or how we need to handle the aftermath of the Me Too movement or whatever. You know, we're so afraid of the abuses of these things that we sometimes miss the meat of them, I'm afraid. All I mean to say is the Bible does have things to say about all those issues, right? And we want to make sure we're sticking to the scriptures, that we're teaching the scriptures, and that we're not afraid to speak to society when it makes society mad. And we also can't be afraid when God says it to speak to society on an issue when it makes our tribe mad. We're not as good at that. You know what I mean?
But, I mean, I think the challenge for me a lot of times, like, I think you said this before, like, people, and I'm guilty of this, and I think people in our church too, like, everybody's got an idea. Like, I think you've told me before, like, people are like, now what we need to be good is this, we need to do this. And your response is like, we're good. Like, you know.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think a lot of
you is we. I love it. Let's do it.
I think that's, but I mean, I, along with probably you're guilty of just thinking, well, what the church needs to be doing, and like, hey, I'm the church.
Yeah, and for me too, Brent, right? I don't want to use that as a cop out either. For me, because I mean, at the same time, God's called me to lead this church to be faithful, you know? And the reality is, I mean, like, you know, I need to make sure that I'm doing the best I can do. And I want to make sure at night I'm thinking about, hey, are we doing all that we need to do, you know, to serve and love our community? And it's real funny, you know, that idea. I mean, that kind of thought that Spurgeon had before the orphanages started, it's kind of been brewing in my heart for a while now. Just, you know, I think we ought to be taking on a new work. And I don't know what it is quite yet, but I think God may. And I think God does, you know, and I feel that. I feel that all the time. I think a lot.
Even in our local, man, we just left a meeting talking about how we made budget. And I'm not getting in the meat here, but it's like, that's the kind of things to think about. It's like, sit on this stuff.
You know, it's a temptation. Let me say this about that. It's about resources and people in a church. We all know what I'm tempted to think, right? That's the end game. Budget's good. Pews are filling up. I've done a good job this year. That's not the end. That's the means by which we do ministry. That's fuel, right? And so that's when ministry starts, really. In fact, I think you could even argue we're a step behind that. You know, we weren't waiting in faith to get something rolling, you know, but whatever. COVID, am I right? Sorry. I was just going to blame COVID.
No, I said, God might be trying to tell us something.
Yeah, I think so. Let's get after it. I'm not sitting here saying we're not doing. I think we've been real faithful with all God's given us, you know, but he's given us more, and it's time to figure out what's next. I'll tell you what's been brewing in my heart is just this idea that I hope and pray. I'll tell you how I've today, as of today, how I've put all this together. Y'all want to know, or you want to leave? Okay. I think my hope and my prayer is that this church right here can be an engine for the gospel in this region. So I want to think through how can we not just preach the gospel, but not stop doing that? And how can we not just impact individuals around us? We can't stop doing that. But how do we take the resources God's given us and become an engine that produces multiplying gospel impact all around the region? So through raising up pastors, through caring for our community, through all kinds of different things. Things I can't even imagine because God's put it on other people's hearts, I hope. You know, but we become an engine. Once you build the engine, Henry Ford didn't know where all that thing would go, you know, where all those cars would go, but they went. And I just want us to start thinking a lot about how to be a gospel engine to impact this area. And so I just think a lot about, okay, how can Northeast Alabama be transformed by the gospel? You know, and that means people being saved, lives being changed, but also how do we make Northeast Alabama look like heaven? You know, that's part of what God, Jesus told us to pray. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. How does Northeast Alabama start to look more like heaven, and what's our role in that? So for me, it's sort of like, how do we become an engine that produces gospel transformation? That's what I'm wrestling with, you know, and thinking through. And what are the areas that God would call us to impact right now? What are the things that our church could change, you know?
You know, Matt, sometimes a good thing doesn't need changing.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
That only has a traditional service.
Sure.
I mean, and you feel like you've been to worship and you worship God and the singing. I mean, it's only one in how many churches in that Ottawa County?
Sure, sure, sure.
I mean, we visit a lot and it's amazing.
Yeah.
The engine is going in the right
direction. Yeah, I think we're just talking about how we can impact our society, not necessarily changing things inside here, but how can we make an impact outside our walls? That's really what I'm talking about. Don't panic, everybody. Don't panic. A bunch, you know, we'll see. But I'm just saying this to me, like when I look at like the tabernacle, and that's one example, but lots of different ways, just churches that made impact over the decades. That's essentially what it looked like where, you know, people and resources are flocking to hear the gospel. And it comes in and it gets somehow converted into steam. You know, gospel steam just impacts the world around us. I don't really know exactly, you know. I mean, I know there's a lot of hungry people. I know there's a lot of hurting people. I know there's great mental health needs. I mean, there's all kinds of needs. We don't want to replicate what everybody else is doing necessarily. You know, we want to join in where that's already been done well.
There's not enough mental health.
No, there's not. No, there's not. Yeah, so we just want to be ready to do what the Lord calls us to do, right? And take what God's given us and turn it into impact for the gospel. See people saved and see the world, our region transformed with the gospel. I think we can see that happen. I think we can churn people out.
I think something for that. That I've been involved with several times before COVID started, and that was we would have a breakfast for our community workers, our city workers,
mm-hmm.
fire. And that went over.
Love it.
It was a pretty good.
I love it. Yeah, any way we can show love to our community is great. I mean, I love that. I love it. And that stuff, you know, that, I mean, all this is stuff that it's not like we got to wait till tomorrow, you know, or I guess we have to wait till tomorrow now, but for breakfast. But you know, I mean, it's not stuff that, like, is out there. I mean, that's stuff we could do tomorrow. I mean, literally, you know, and you know, I'm just saying what I'm thinking through is a lot. Do you have to choose? This is the last thing I'll say. I don't think you have to choose between being a gospel preaching church, right? preaching the gospel, telling people about Jesus, seeing people saved, baptizing folks, teaching, preaching, all those things, and seeing the world around you transformed. I don't think you have to choose between those two things. And that's what I'm praying for God to do here, right? Is for us to continue to pull those two things together. And I think we're doing a really good job of it sort of right now. I think we're kind of a gospel bicycle in a really good way. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, the energy that's coming in is going out and it's healthy, you know? But I'm just thinking a lot about how, not about growth as much as impact, right? How do we make it an engine where what's coming in is getting turned into something bigger than it is already? You know, we know how to turn legs into forward motion. How do we turn gas? How do we turn an explosion? You know, how do we make it react in certain ways? That's what I'm thinking through. Yeah.
It wasn't all for them. It wasn't a big program or a big. It was just anybody they were around. You know,
yeah.
You know, think about like if everybody just, you know, the little things, the stories, you know, we all talk about showing up and babysitting a stranger's house or somebody. Else,
sure.
Or like just being kind or taking somebody to lunch. And like if everybody just happened to do that on the same day, like that happens. That has lasting, you know, it's like it's both ends. Like,
yeah.
It doesn't always have to be just, all right, we've got to sit around talking about what program we start.
Yeah, I agree.
Ministry, it's like you can do something tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah.
The best way to change the world is just,
start doing it.
That's what Roger and Peggy did. I mean, you know, anybody's ever around, they had something.
Yeah, that's right. That's a good point. All right. Let's pray. Lord, we thank you so much for Jesus. We thank you for his gospel. God, I thank you for the fact that it's a gospel that saves our souls, God, but also impacts our world. And God, I pray that you'll continue to put on our heart ways that we can impact the world around us. And in simple ways. And God, maybe you want to bring us all together and do it in big ways. Who knows? Who knows what you have in store? Lord, our prayer is that as people and resources come in and you give us grace and give us the gospel and we grow, God, I just pray that you'll put us to work. Continue to put us to work. You already have. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you all.